Welcome to a very special Halloween edition of the Life 2.0 podcast. Let's get to it, shall we? So great to have you on Halloween 2020. This is a late edition, no doubt about that. I've been busy all day, but in the back of my mind, I wanted to at least get a little bit of time in behind the microphone and talk about Halloween, which was, you know, the thing for my house growing up. And every Halloween, I do get a little bit overboard posting about my dad. This is the guy who, you know, most people knew for 11 months out of the year as Mr. Banker. He was a tie-sporting, hard sole shoe wearing, slicked back with Brill Cream, Old Spice kind of guy who shed all his daily trappings for the whole month of October to scare the livid shit out of people, morphing into the Prince of Darkness, Dracula, right before my eyes. So I can't help. You have to give me a little leeway. You know, I think of him every day, but more often than not, it's during the month of October. And I'll tell you what, with Halloween falling on a Saturday, that would have been prime scaring time for my old man. A lot of times, you know, we would be open for like 2 weeks before Halloween, and Halloween would be on a Wednesday or a Thursday, but this is a Saturday night, and that would have been something. As legend tells it, my pop was the kind of guy that fell right into that whole sci-fi horror movie genre back in the 50s and 60s. Werewolves, cabbage-headed aliens, giant spiders, mummies, and of course, Dracula. And while my dad really had great respect for Bela Lugosi, he thought that the late, great Christopher Lee was the ultimate master vampire. He started building haunted houses when he was a teenager, much to the dismay of my grandmother, for the most part. And many years later, when he had established his career and his family and realized that this big house on Berto Avenue that we lived in had the perfect basement set up to build the ultimate chamber of horrors. It had an outside back entrance underneath that went into the basement, and then stairs that led up to the house from the basement, so you could cycle people right through. And to him, this was, I mean, you couldn't have designed it any better. So they would get to start building mazes in the basement, usually around September. It'd be my cousins and neighbors and friends, and everything would come out of the basement. And there was few things in my life that were so much fun as walking home from school, whether it was, you know, seventh, eighth grade, even in high school, and seeing all my cousins' cars parked in front of our house. And that meant to me that they were working on the basement, getting it ready for Halloween. And my mom would put out apple cider in the backyard. And man, it was just a very, very cool thing. So anyway, they would build these mazes through the basement, and that would basically take these unsuspecting victims once they signed in on the ghost book underneath the back stairs. They signed in blood, of course. It was just a red pen, but it was so cool to having to watch various Dr. Frankensteins bring the monster to life in the laboratory. And then they'd go down pitch dark hallways that seemed to go on forever. My dad and cousins were masters at taking these cardboard mazes and zigzagging people. And it felt like you were in there for a month. And the basement wasn't that big, but with the mazes, it sure seemed that way. Of course, there were ghouls and goblins and assorted creatures of the night at every corner. The early Monster Squad had my cousin, the Sarge, Rich Hoffman, as the ever-suffering Wolfman, chained to the wall. Just before people were about to leave and go up the stairs, he was seemingly protected. The victims were protected as my dad, Dracula, would hold Rich at bay. Back! 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 And he was like chained up to the wall. And it was the coolest effect I'd ever seen. They had these plastic chains that were nailed to the wall, Got him at the, what was the name of that place? Cars 5 and Dime on Montrose and Central. It was this huge Halloween warehouse, and they were these plastic chains. What they did was take a couple of metal coat hangers and make the ends look like chain links wrapped in black tape, and they would put them around Rich's wrists, but they were just open at the end. So it looked like he had a chain on him, but he would just break through, and my dad would try to hold it back. It was fantastic. His brother Bob, Rich's brother Bobby, was a caveman for a couple of years. He was like in a corner, and when the victims approached, he could hear them coming, and he would step on a little switch, and this red light would go on over his head. So here's this guy dressed as a caveman. I mean, he smelled and everything. There was like, we found an old elk hide in the alley, actually. And we put that behind him, and it stunk to high heaven. It was like a caveman's cave, for lack of a better term. Long before man cave, we had that in the basement. So we'd step on this light. The whole corner would be illuminated. And he'd yell at the unsuspecting victims. He had a rubber spider in his mouth. It was as big as my hand, and it was attached to an elastic cord. And so the light would go on, and he'd yell, he had a club in his, he was going to club people. Ah! And the spider, of course, would launch out of his mouth and always hit some poor young girl or other kid in the face, and they'd go off screaming. It was so great. And then my Uncle Sam was kind of like a runner monster. He'd be up at the front harassing people, then you'd run into him again at the back, you know, from behind the scenes. It's just great stuff. But before all people got to the maze, really, the shining jewel of this whole deal was Dr. Frankenstein's laboratory, which was really the main event. You'd sign in the book, and you'd walk in there, and inside there was this laboratory built, and the walls were painted by my Uncle Hal, who put these cardboard walls and made them come alive with incredible images. It was hard to tell they weren't real because they were in phosphorescent paint, and we had black lights and all that. Beakers, skulls, books on creating monsters. And behind the curtain, there was like a, what was the name of that? Hot Wheels had a little motor that you could hook up to your bike, and it would roar. And so we had that behind there, using that like the sound of the monster. It was great. And the curtains were closed. And there on the slab with 7-Up lights. I don't know if you know what 7-Up lights are. They're back from the 70s. And there were these bulbs that kind of flickered a certain way. And I don't even know why they called them 7-Up lights. It might have been in a commercial. But those were next to the voltage bolts on Frankenstein, the monster. And there were 3 or 4 guys that played Frankenstein, as I recall. There was Mr. Stitch from across the street, who he was okay. He was probably a 6-foot tall guy. He had a rubber mask on, did okay. And then they went from Mr. Stitch to Kenny Sauerwine, who was about 6'2", about 250 pounds, got a little bigger Frankenstein. And then we got my buddy who played football with me at Schur's, the late, great Albert Walschlager Jr., who Albert was probably 6'4", about 250 pounds. He was a big kid, so we stuck him back there. And in the whole 20 years that we did this, there was only 2 Dr. Frankensteins. One was a guy named Tom Marins, who was a buddy of my dad's. And when he passed away, a buddy of mine named Jerry Olive took over for it was like a 10 years for one guy and 10 years for the next guy. It was really great. And so, you know, you walk in there, And the laboratory's going, and people are huddled up screaming, and my dad's pretending like he's going to protect him and stuff like that. And as soon as they open that curtain, and whether it was Mr. Stitch or Kenny Sauerwine or Big Al, and they came out with those man, that was it. I mean, you know, grown men were screaming for their lives. Women nearly fainted. Kids are shrieking. And my dad would just smile. It was just, it was really something. So over time, some of my friends got in on the act. Their places among the great ones, as I said, Dr. Frankenstein, the monster. Mike Arend came up with his own gig. He was a crazed prisoner at the end of one of the hallways, and he had the same deal. He could click on a light switch, a strobe light, and he'd be sitting there, and he was a goalie in hockey, so he was used to being down and putting his leg behind him and stuff. So he had one leg that was out in front of him that was fake. And he took this circular saw, and he was cutting his leg off. He really ushered in the whole slasher end of the haunted house. My buddy Al I've known the, he was the guy I've known the longest. We stuck him in a coffin one time, and there was a stake in there. He was dressed up like a vampire, and some kid came along and grabbed the stake and literally tried to shove it into Al's chest. That didn't, I don't know if we stick around after that or we kind of cut him loose, but it was really funny that, now it's funny. It wasn't funny that night, that's for sure. But it was really, really something. And, you know, no one ever took the place of the Sarge as Wolfman over 20 years and such great, great memories. And for me, when I was a kid, I would sit at the very top of the stairs in the dark with a flashlight in this horrible mask sitting under an oilcloth. And people thought they were home free. And man, I'd reach out and grab them. And it was just a hell of a lot of fun. You got to remember back then, this is before all these big business horror shows and horror fests and the haunted houses that you got to spend $20-$30. And now with COVID, nobody's doing it. But back then, the only other real horror fest was a place called Amling's. And it was like a landscape place or something out near Des Plaines, Illinois, or over that way. And it was Amling's, and they had gotten written up in the news a few times. And then my dad or somebody tipped off the Chicago Tribune that, hey, we're doing stuff over here right in the city. So some reporter actually showed up one year and did a couple lines in a paragraph saying how great it was on the Northwest side that this was going on. We were probably 10 years into the deal at that point. And you would have thought when that paper came out, my dad won an Academy Award for his performance as Dracula because he framed that whole thing. It was just the biggest thing to him. And, you know, the best supporting Oscar, I guess you could say, or for makeup would go to my mom, who every year painstakingly transformed my dad into Count Dracula. My dad went as far as getting his dentist to make fangs that he could put in his mouth. And I got to tell you, you know, I would sit and watch my dad in front of the big dresser in my folks' bedroom, and he would sit there looking like my dad, like I knew him. And pretty soon my mom would start all the different makeups and stuff, and he'd sat there just like it was a movie. And it would probably take an hour for her to get him. And I would look at him, and he'd be changing, and I thought, this is, you know. And again, I live with this guy, and it was starting to scare the shit out of me. And by the time he was done, he would sit there in front of that. He had, you know, the white shirt on, and he had this huge medallion around his neck, and he had a cape that my mom made out of curtains from my bedroom that were pitch black because my room was up front of the house. It was good to keep the light out and stuff like that. So anyway, when she changed those out, she took those heavy black curtains and sewed a cape for him with the big collar and the whole drill. And to see him literally before my eyes turn into Count Dracula was something. And even when we'd go and walk through the basement on our final walkthrough, it was just me and my dad. And we had all kind of skulls and lights set up and stuff. And, you know, there's people lined up down the street waiting to get in, and the monsters are taking their place. And here's me and my dad doing like the final check-throughs. And even then I got a little shaky, you know? I mean, we're in the dark, and I know it's my dad, but Jesus, age tap dancing Christ, it looks like Christopher Lee. So that was a long time ago. Halloween was bigger than Christmas at our house. And to this day, and maybe one of the reasons I still do this is to think of him like that. This is a guy who worked very, very hard in his life. He always wanted to be an architect. That never happened for him. But what did happen for him is for 20 years, for two decades, he was able to scare the crap out of people, and he got a lot of joy out of that. You know, the only real relic from those days is a jointed life-size paper skeleton called Mr. Bones. We probably paid $6, $8, $9, $10 for this stuff back in 1967. That was 50 years ago or more. You can find those now for about $150 on eBay. And matter of fact, there's a couple of pieces of paperwork that we found, and I have them framed here in my office, of the maze and article that was done to like a flyer to get people to show up. 25 cents he charged to get into the basement just to offset the cost of all the stuff that he bought. And matter of fact, the saw that Mike Arend used to try and cut his leg off every night over and over and over again is out in the garage, and there's still flecks of glow-in-the-dark paint on it all these decades later. So, you know, this is one of those things, I think, that for me is such a great memory, and I could have jumped over it and, you know, let it go. Like I said, it's Saturday. It's late. I don't know how many people are going to hear this tonight, but I wanted to share that about my dad and my mom, too, and what a great time that was for those 20 years, something to look forward to every October. And it was very, very, very cool. I wrote a book in 2018 going into 2019 called Phenomena, Sacred Moments, Messages, Memories, and Other Shit That I Can't Explain. And all of it really stems from an electrical incident that happened to me when I was 19 years old working at an Osco drugstore in Chicago. And the electrical shock, I am more than 100% sure, somehow rewired me, no pun intended. And I've had so many very strange episodes and events and occurrences and visitations and stuff that I'd rather skip, but apparently is part of my deal. And as I was sitting down, just getting ready to do this show tonight, I thought, you know, outside of, you know, some of the things that are in this book that I know I experienced that were relatively, they made me uneasy, but they weren't scary to me. I had to think about what I thought might be the scariest thing that happened or something that really, really, really unnerved me. And I immediately thought of chapter 10 of the book, and I will share it with you on this Halloween. Etched in stone. At 6:30 in the morning on July 24th, 1915, in spite of the steady rain, a massive crowd had gathered and was beginning to board the SS Eastland docked at the Clark Street Bridge on the Chicago River between Clark and LaSalle Street. It was, by all accounts, a most anticipated event for thousands of employees of the Western Electric Hawthorne Works plant based in Cicero, Illinois. They would be embarking on a boat trip across Lake Michigan to the 5th annual company picnic in Michigan City, Indiana. This was a very big deal to most of the employees, many of whom could never imagine taking a holiday such as this one. The Eastland was known as the Speed Queen of the Great Lakes and was one of the 5 excursion boats, along with the Theodore Roosevelt, the Petoskey, Racine, and Rochester, that were chartered to take employees to the picnic for a day of relaxation and festivities. In some cases, entire families made their way on board the Eastland in anticipation of the celebration. However, the Eastland had serious design flaws when it was built in 1902, one problem being it was very top-heavy. There were 2 incidences shortly after the ship launched that involved a serious list or a lean to one side, and the ship was also damaged when it backed into a tugboat in 1903. In addition, after the sinking of the Titanic in 1912, new rules placed lifeboats and preservers on the top deck, which made the already unstable ship even more treacherous. Shortly after 7 a.m., the ship was filled to capacity with 2,752 people on board, many of them on the upper deck of the boat standing on the port side away from the dock to get a view of the river. Due to the weight imbalance, the ship began to list toward the water, to which the crew opened the ballast tanks that they could fill them with water and put the ship back on a center line. Didn't work. At 7:28 a.m., the ship suddenly lurched sharply away from the dock and rolled fully on its port side and began to sink rapidly in the murky water. Those who were on the top decks were tossed into the river. Those who had moved below were trapped inside as the side of the ship came to rest on the bottom, just 20 feet below the surface. Those below decks were crushed by the sheer weight of the water, along with heavy furniture, pianos, bookcases, and trunks. In spite of the quick response by the Kenosha, which was close by in the river, a total of 844 passengers and 4 crew members died in this tragedy. In just 15 minutes, 22 families were wiped out. The river was filled with bodies of infants and children, teenagers and the elderly, and every age in between. Well-wishers and neighbors who had come to see their friends off on a holiday end up using gaff hooks and ladders to pull their loved ones out of the river. Eventually, divers were used to recover dozens of corpses. Bystanders helped laying out the bodies so they could be transported to the various morgues in the area. And by that afternoon, the remaining unidentified bodies were taken to the armory of the 2nd Regiment on Washington Boulevard, just a few blocks from the river. The Eastland tragedy claimed nearly more than 3 times the lives than the Great Chicago Fire in 1871. So why the history lesson? Well, as it turns out, the armory of the 2nd Regiment on Washington Street, where that makeshift morgue was set up, with the blocks of ice next to the bodies of those Eastland victims, would eventually become Harpo Studios, home of the Oprah Winfrey Show. I began working across the street from that main studio in 2006, developing and creating Oprah and Friends for Sirius XM Radio, along with a stellar group of broadcasting professionals. I had great satisfaction in building the concept from the ground up to a viable satellite channel for about 4 years. I was the senior producer of two daily programs, The Dr. Oz Show and The Gene Chatsky Show, along with Bob Green's weekly hour on health and fitness. My team kept a serious pace, but we had a pretty good time doing it as well. In October of 2008, we were taping with Gene Chatsky, the financial editor of the Today Show at that point, in Edit One, which is a small studio we use mostly for post-production, but occasionally was pressed into service to record shows as well. While normally her Oprah radio shows had to do with money, for fun and something a little different, I scheduled a Halloween show, and being the pro she is, she went right along with the program. So, Gene was locked in on an ISDN line, which is basically a closed-circuit dedicated line from her home outside of New York, and on the guest phone line was my old friend and the guy who I dedicated this book to, the late, great Richard Crowe, a.k.a. the Ghost Hunter, and a lifelong Chicago historian. I had met this remarkable man at the Alexander Robinson burial grounds many years before, and we became good friends. And when it was time to tape a Halloween show for Gene, Richard was my go-to guy. For this particular outing, we had Richard talking with Gene about all the haunted places in Chicago, the stops he made as the guide of the supernatural tours, which included the site of the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, the aforementioned burial ground of Alexander Robinson, searching for the ghost of Clarence Darrow by the Jackson Park Lagoon, and perhaps most famous of them all, Resurrection Mary, who is a hitchhiking ghost that picks up rides in the cars of unsuspecting gentlemen, only to vanish when they get to the gates of Resurrection Cemetery. That's some scary shit. The main reason I wanted Richard on the show was to talk about the Eastland tragedy and the numerous sightings of the Gray Lady in the lower level of the main Harpo Studios across the street, who was presumed to be one of the drowning victims and whose body was brought to the makeshift morgue back in 1915. Now and then, I would hear the security guys talking about some of the odd noises and things that were purported to be heard when they were walking through the building. The sound of music and crying. And one of them mentioned that there was actually security camera footage of this apparition caught on film as proof. However, none of that stuff happened in the building I worked in, located kitty corner across the street from the main building. Or so I thought. During this particular recording session, there were three and sometimes four of us crammed into the little edit suite. Myself, Katie, my board op, Teresa from Legal, and Matt, one of our engineers who always kept the tech vigil whenever we taped via ISDN. Richard had done a great job sharing some of his more chilling moments with Gene, who took it all in. And so we wrap up the show. I thank Richard for his time and dedication. We let him go on the phone and closed off that line. We're having small conversation via a talkback speaker with Gene on this closed circuit line. Katie's mixing down the audio tape. Matt and Teresa are hanging out as we get ready to tape another show. And that's when it happened. A distended voice filled the room. Niels Petersen will not be forgotten. What was that? And then it happened again. It sounds like it's coming from a small auxiliary speaker that isn't even turned on or being used in any way, shape, or form. And that was more demanding. Niels Petersen will not be forgotten. We all just sat there with our mouths hanging open. Even Gene heard it through the talkback line all the way in New York. What the F was that, I said. Katie's eyes were big as saucers. Teresa didn't know quite what to say. And Matt, being the guy he is, scribbled down the name all three of us heard. The crew definitely needed a timeout, and I opened the door to the little room, letting some fresh air in and whatever the heck that was out. Word of the encounter spread fast, and after another check of the wiring with regards to recording and editing, it was determined there was no way for a voice from any outside source to have come through that speaker that wasn't even turned on. Eventually, we resumed taping Gene's show with the door open, and that was the end of it, for about 3 hours. Later that afternoon, Matt comes into my office and says, "You're not going to believe this." He had dug through the list of victims that died in the Eastland disaster in 1915. Petersen, Niels, Nelson Rasmus, 46 years old, married, Danish, buried in Oak Ridge Cemetery, foreman, Western Electric Company. Unbelievable! And yet, we all heard it. From a speaker that wasn't even plugged into the audio board. I don't know how long it took us to start using that edit suite again or how many times I turned on all the lights if I was working late at the studio, but to this day, if I bring up that visit with those of us that were there, the hair on my neck stands up. and it's doing it as I'm doing this show right now. So what was that all about? Still not quite sure. Shortly thereafter, I started digging into the electronic voice phenomena, which is called EVP for short, which are sounds found on electronic recordings that are interpreted, quote, as spirit voices that have either been unintentionally recorded or intentionally requested and got recorded. It was the famed parapsychologist Constance Raudiv who popularized the idea in the 70s and described EVP as a typically brief event, usually the length of a word or short phrase. But if that's the description, we weren't requesting shit from Niels Peterson or anyone else for that matter. The short phrase thing fits, and as I recall, the voice was clear, concise, matter of fact, as if making a declaration of sorts. And that multiple people heard it was very unusual, as if hearing voices from a speaker that's not plugged in is what, normal? Whose voice was it? What about Mr. Peterson shouldn't be forgotten? Later that week, I finally mustered up the courage to call Richard at his office and share what happened. He wasn't at all surprised, thought it was very cool, actually, and told me to let him know if it happened again. I assured him that he'd be the first person I called, but once was enough for me. As I began to make a list of experiences I've had that would eventually become chapters in this book, including those that multiple people witnessed were of a high priority to me, it's one thing for me to have a dream, a visit, or unexplained phenomena, but another for a group encounter like this one that, in my opinion, links credibility and credence to the overall message and intent of this book. And what is that message exactly? That there's far more going on than meets the eye, and that for whatever reason, at times the veil between here and there, I guess, gets very thin. These experiences, while at times unnerving to me, are also somehow normal when it comes to the lingering life force of energy that each of us carries while we're alive, and apparently can still manifest after we're long gone. The former Harpo Studios is now the headquarters of that fast food chain with the golden arches that sells billions of burgers. Not sure what's across the street where our radio studios used to be. I don't go to that part of the city much anymore. I often wonder if all that digging in the ground at the site that one time held the bodies of so many that died tragically in the Eastland has further disturbed those who seem to be spiritually interred there, even though their bodies are buried somewhere else. I wouldn't be one bit surprised if they make their presence known in some way, shape, or form. While writing this chapter, it got on me big time to locate this Oak Ridge Cemetery where this guy was buried. And as fate would have it, it's very close to where I live. Maybe a 10-minute walk? We did a little digging, no pun intended, and found Niels in Section 12, Plot 96. And as it turned out, he's buried there with his little 4-year-old son, Royal, who also drowned along with his father. His wife, Viola, survived the horror of the Eastland, buried her husband and boy, and after a second marriage and restarting her family, died at the very young age of 37. At first, seeing their names on that grave marker sparked a deep sense of sadness as I wondered if anyone had ever visited their resting place in the past century plus. And then came a feeling of kind of like mission accomplished, as the only reason I was even standing on that spot looking at that marker was because of a distended voice on a radio speaker over a decade before. Over time, their stone had been slowly sliding off its base, so I moved it back to its original position. I scraped off the lichen and the dirt. I cleaned out the deep grooves worn into the marker. And oddly enough, if you view the memorial from the side, it's a book carved in stone with Niels and Royal's names etched on the pages, the days they were born and the days they died together. To that end, I now make routine visits to the resting place of this father and his son. It gives me a chance to take a few minutes to think about that July day 105 years ago, when there was no way that Niels and little Royal could have known that it would be their last, and that they would be buried side by side for eternity. And if nothing else, because you're reading these words and hearing me share this with you, if only for the length of this chapter that I read, then they are in fact are not forgotten. That was one of those events that I just can't explain. It's exactly why it's in the book. And the last thing I want to share with you on this Halloween is something that was didn't show up until after the event itself. My alma mater, Schurz High School, is located on the northwest side of Chicago. It's a massive structure. It's a block long and a mile wide, they call it. And it's a big place. It's the second largest high school, at least it was back when I was there in the 70s, second largest high school in the city. But it was built in 1910, and thousands of kids have gone through there. And of course, there have been things that have happened in there that people have passed away and such like that, that have had investigations going on in there from various people over time, and things that can't be explained and all that type of stuff. So let me just be real clear. I'm not comfortable with any of this. This is not a hobby of mine. I don't go out looking for this stuff, but when things happen, I don't ignore them either. And I was there in I was in there last year to do a podcast with a group of kids from my friend Kathy Wren's class. And these are seniors. And there was a competition with National Public Radio to do a podcast. And she asked if I would help. And I said, yes. And so I went in there for about a month, and I teach the kids radio and things like that. And the subject was unsocial media, how difficult it is to be a young person today with all the pressures of social media. And so we're getting ready to do the whole final thing. We only had 12 minutes to pull this together. And they had the library, which I didn't spend a whole hell of a lot of time in when I went to school there, to be honest with you. The library was set up in a way that we had a couple classes come in to be our audience. I had placed, you know, everything set up for the audio, the microphones. We had 4, 5, 6 kids at the table. They were our group. We had a host and a moderator. It was you know, we kind of just got this thing pulled together in the library. And I had everything set up. And we start recording. I turn the machine on. Everything's going. I had a Zoom H4N handheld, it's called. It's a great machine, and I can hook up a bunch of mics to it, and that would capture all the audio. And so the opening remarks were from the principal, Mr. Rodriguez. And so, you know, we had the host. He introduces the principal, and Mr. Rodriguez gives all these great remarks, and then we're going to get into the show. And so I had everything running. You know, I could hear the background and everything, and I tested it. It was good to go. And I sat down next to the machine, and I'm really listening to Dr. Rodriguez speak. And I happen to glance over at the machine, and there's, even though he's talking directly into the microphone, there's nothing registering on the audio. There's no bars moving. There's nothing. There's no levels. And I looked, and I looked back again, and I looked a third time. I'm like, what? But it's on. You know, the numbers are rolling, but it's not recording anything. And how is that possible? This went on for about 2.5 minutes. So I finally had to stop, which I hated to do because we'd worked a month on this. I said, so let's stop and start over. And that was it. So I pressed save on that 2 minutes and 40 seconds. And then I restarted the machine and we did the event. And it turned out real well. So that afternoon or the next day, I don't recall, I get back to my office and I'm starting to pull this audio off. And that's right. I had to do a restart. What was that all about? And so I was sitting here listening to this audio, which has no levels or peaks or valleys or anything on it, on the signature chart. And all of a sudden this voice shows up. Man, the hair on my right leg just freaking stood up. And this voice shows up. It's unintelligible to me. Oh my gosh. It's unintelligible to me. But it's there. And if you could see the hair on my arms right now, okie dokie. And so I sent the audio to Kathy, and I said, can you hear this? And she heard it, and she sent it to Dr. Rodriguez, and he heard it. And it turns out, because I don't keep up with a lot of stuff, that's where I learned that there'd been some paranormal stuff going on there, investigations going on in there. And I remember Kathy telling me that her room is downstairs on the lower level, right next to the library. So the library, you know, has two entrances and exits. The entrance is in the front, the exits to the side. And one of the exits dumps out into a hallway right by her classroom. And she said, I have seen a man in a black coat and a hat who visited me in my classroom as he took a shortcut through the library into my room and then out the door. Now, I didn't witness that, but she sent me that message and I just thought, man. So here's the deal. You know, I think you might want to hear that. This is what was on the audio. I think you need a bit of a laugh. Thank you for joining us on this special day.
No, I understand broadly that.
So you decide for yourself. It's not been manipulated any way, shape, or form. I don't even know what to do with it. I had to go dig it out from the hard drive of my computer just to find it. And I had forgotten what that sounded like. So I don't know who it was or what it was. But all I know is for that 2 minutes and 38 seconds, it was totally, as you heard coming into the clip, there was a background noise. And all of a sudden, there's nothing. And then there's this voice. I can't understand what it's saying. And then that was it. A couple times. So is it EVP? No clue. I don't want to ever, listen, I just think there's a lot going on in the world we can't explain. And I think it's too easy to just slough stuff off and say, oh, that's not this or not that. That's fine. But I will tell you, especially as I read from about Etched in Stone and some of the other events and experiences in my life, that I don't look at life that way anymore. I don't know exactly what's going on. It's best that I don't, but I also don't dismiss it. And I guess for me at this point, that's really the message. So I appreciate you taking your time to listen to this Halloween special. A little bit about my dad and the Sarge who played the Wolfman and all my friends that had such a great time scaring people on Halloween. That's like the traditional stuff. This other stuff here that I can't explain that goes on, I think that in some way, shape, or form, it's part of the mosaic of life. We just don't pay attention to it. We're disconnected from it. I can't explain it, and I don't want to. So I just offer it up, and you get to decide. Until next time, safe travels. Happy Halloween. Adios.
I saw a werewolf with a Chinese menu in his hand, walking through the streets of Soho in the rain. He was looking for the place called Lee Ho Fook's, gonna get a big dish of beef chow mein.